Good afternoon, everyone. Good to see you all once again. It's been quite a while since we've been able to visit here. We always look forward to it when we have the opportunity. But they've asked us to have another congregation up in Beloit, Wisconsin, and it's made it a little bit more difficult to get away. But we look forward to the opportunity to be here. Now, they say confession is good for the soul. I'm the mysterious telephoner. Mr. Hargrove should have had his phone off. That's what it's probably written in the bulletin. Actually, it's a good thing he didn't, because God was looking out for me. I didn't know where I was supposed to go. We printed up the various announcements for this occasion and the maps and everything, and we put them on the table, and everyone disappeared. So we didn't have one ourselves, and we didn't get around to getting it returned again. So that's our problem. But anyway, first of all, I want to thank Mrs. Hargrove and the other ladies who invited us to come and participate in this weekend. It's a privilege, and we have look forward to it. And I hope you have a really pleasant weekend. We really appreciate it, the opportunity to participate. As you know, marriage conflict is growing in our society, and I don't think I need to explain that. I think you know it very well indeed. You know, if you have family and friends, as we all do in this world, you'll have evidence enough. Sadly, marriage conflict seems to be growing within God's church. When I first arrived at Ambassador College in 1961, the college had been going for 14 years. And during that time, no Ambassador College student or graduate had ever experienced divorce. And that was something we were quite pleased about. We thought that was very good. That was a period of 14 years, from 1947 to 1961. I knew the first Ambassador College couple that divorced. They married while I was still in Pasadena. I was in Pasadena from 1961 to 1963, and then I was transferred to the Brickett Wood campus. But in the time I was in Pasadena, I knew them. And they divorced some time later. I don't know how long it was, and I have no other details. But when we heard about it, we were stunned. It was stunning that there was actually a divorce in that situation. But if you were to talk to more recent graduates of Ambassador College, especially in the last few years, you may be shocked if they told you how many of their classmates have had to endure divorce, have had to go through it. It's really astonishing. Surely nobody plans a divorce, yet it came upon them. The motto for Ambassador College was "Recapture True Values." But in the latter years, it seems that the concept was mostly in the handbook and less in the instruction and the teaching, or at least in the results. I'm sure everybody tried to teach the best they could, but it still came upon them. And we followed, sadly, perhaps belatedly, the trends that were going on in society and what was happening out there. While we hear many sad stories, today I want to focus on an example of success. And it's an example that I feel has been often misunderstood. What do you think of when I say Proverbs 31? Well, usually we think of the description of a virtuous woman, and so it is. One lady told me some years ago she felt the pressure of that so strongly that she wished there were a similar chapter for men, maybe another one for the guys to be able to have one that they could look to. And I feel that view is incomplete. I think Proverbs 31 describes a virtuous couple, not just a virtuous woman. As I said in the title, there's a guy hiding in there. And today I want to help get him out of the shrubbery there and able to be seen. No wife works in a vacuum. She's part of a team. What she does affects him. What he does affects her. And when they're working together, there's a beautiful synergy that goes together. That's really an amazing thing. This passage is usually read with only the woman in mind. And I plan to do that first. Just read it through and just look at it for what it says as we read through it. But then we'll read through it again with the couple in mind. And we'll try to see the couple more than just the one partner in the marriage. And we're going to ask the question, what kind of a guy has a wife like this? In today's world, men and women are increasingly in competition. Competition between the sexes, of course, leads to division. Satan, the adversary, promotes division at every level. He does it between labor and management. He does it between rich and poor. He does it between black and white. He does it between north and south. He does it between Democrats and Republicans, and it's on broad display now in our election campaign of the banging heads together, disagreeing and arguing with anything. And he also does it with men and women, puts them against each other rather than working together. God's intention is that people work together in harmony, that labor and management work together in harmony, that rich and poor work together in harmony, that black and white work together in harmony, that north and south work together in harmony, that Democrats and Republicans work together in harmony. But would you have Democrats and Republicans then? Wouldn't you just have Americans? And that men and women work together in harmony, each working for the good of the other and for the family or the nation as a whole, each using their individual talents and abilities to benefit mutually. As we'll see, the guy and gal in Proverbs 31 are in absolute harmony. Now, let's just read through it, as I said, as it's normally read through, and go through this passage of Scripture, Proverbs 31, beginning in verse 10. It says, "Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her. He will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works willingly with her hands. She's like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it's yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it, and from her profits she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and she strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hand to the distaff, and her hand holds the spindle, and extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hand to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself, and her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also. He praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates." Now, we can see why, just reading it through like that, most people think it's directed or talking about the lady primarily. She is the focus of the discussion. And then that's a certain pressure. Who can measure up to this at such a high standard? It's a very high standard. Naturally, we look at this from our perspective here in the 21st century. Today, homemaking is often seen in a negative light. People are encouraged, ladies especially, to be in the corporate world, competing with men, meeting important deadlines and making significant business deals or decisions, doing their thing, as it says. Let's acknowledge, first of all, that there are many opportunities for women today that are truly remarkable. There are many opportunities that weren't available in past years for accomplishment, for education, for success, for in all kinds of fields. And it's wonderful to have those opportunities, and it's a blessing to be able to do them. On the other hand, people are beginning to recognize some downsides on this. They're beginning to see some of the downsides. Many couples find it difficult when both work outside the home. It's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of work. And they end up leading basically separate lives, going in separate directions. This can lead to loneliness and feeling unappreciated. And with workmate sometimes 8 to 10 hours a day, you can get into difficulties too when they're seeing this. There is a slight swing back now where some ladies are saying, I'm not going to do that. It's not worth the money. I'm going to stay home and take care. It's only a slight, but there's a beginning of a little bit of a change on that in society today. And of course, all these problems are leading to many broken families. Not all families, of course, but there's pressure. And it's an additional burden. I once went to a seminar, and it was a lady who was conducting it on finance. And she said the last 30 years, inflation had averaged 6% a year. And this was back in the early 90s. And she said, now wages only increased 2% a year during that 30 years. She said, how did we make up the difference? With inflation going at 6 and wages only going at 2, she said, we sent the women out to work. That was her evaluation of it. That's how people could make it go of it in the midst of this financial difficulty that's going on. But today, I said, there's a little bit of a backlash, and deadlines and meetings lose their excitement. Eventually, you recognize, you know, a lot of this is just the rat race. And when older, then family concerns become more important. When you're young, you have to get started, get ahead. The pressures financially are great. But later on, you look back and you say, well, I'm not sure I put my energies in the best spot back then. It's difficult. We live in a difficult society. There are no easy answers. When Evelyn and I were first married, I was a church pastor. Our first pastorate was Glasgow, Scotland. And then after a year there, we were moved to Melbourne, Australia. And as a church pastor, we did everything together. We were out visiting day in and day out. We're home together. We're here. We're there. We did everything together. In 1969, I was transferred to South Africa and became the regional director there. And all of a sudden, I was working in an office and she was home. And this changed the dynamics a lot. She began to feel she'd been retired. She wasn't part of it. And it was a great difficulty. And this caused us some problems for a time. So we've tried to find a way, how could I do this? And finally, I thought about every piece of correspondence I had, I saved in the day and I brought home at night. And so she would read over it, whatever it was going on. And so she participated then in everything in the best way. We did it all those years. And it worked. And we still keep up that way. I share with Evelyn just about every, not every, but 99% or close to of everything I send out. It's a lot better after she has a look at it. I write what I'm feeling, and then she says, do you want to say it that way? So she's become editor-in-chief. She contributes a great deal to my correspondence. But let's view this passage from a historical perspective. Until recently, relatively recently, not 10 years, but more like 30 or 40, in all nations, women had very few privileges, and sometimes they felt like second-class citizens. Some were rigidly under the authority of her father or husband. Many were not educated or able to own property. Even in the U.S., when I was real young, it was unusual for a woman to have her own bank account or her own property. It wasn't a common thing. And now it's accepted as generally so. But that's been a big change if you look over the years as to how that's gone. So it was unusual that they would have checking accounts, mortgages, and properties. But that was never so in Israel. Proverbs 31 describes an extremely capable, well-educated woman with freedom to act. The passage describes a prosperous family in which the woman played a major role. She was free to make decisions and to manage the household. Actually, I see it that she was really the chief executive officer of the household. in the way it ran. If I have a quick look, we'll be back to Proverbs 31. Let's look at Numbers chapter 27. Numbers chapter 27. The children of Israel were on the road, and they hadn't come into the promised land yet. Numbers 27. Then the daughters of Zelophehad, this is Numbers 27, verse 1. Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, from the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and these were the names of his daughters, Mala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. We had a friend in South Africa named Tirzah. And they stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders and all the congregation by the door of the tabernacle of meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord, in company with Korah, but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be removed from among his family because he had no sons? Give us a possession among our father's brothers." They were requesting the property right that belonged to their father, the five daughters. Moses said he would take the hard ones to the Lord. This was a hard one. At least it was for Moses. So Moses brought their court before the Lord. Verse 6, and the Lord said to Moses, "The daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. You shall surely give them the possession of inheritance among their father's brothers and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them. And you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no sons, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughters." And then it goes down the next few verses and it says, well, if there's this condition and this thing, this person's not there, then it goes to that one. It had a way of going on down to cover just about every possible deal that could come up. And verse 11, it says, and if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance they receive to the closest to him in his family, and he shall possess it. And it shall be to the children of Israel a statute of judgment, just as the Lord commanded Moses. That was to be the instruction from then on. And brethren, that was 3,500 years ago that ladies were said that they could control the property and own the property, it could pass to them. That hasn't happened in many nations in the world, but it did in Israel. Now let's look at the couple being described here. Let's look at them together. Back in Proverbs 31. Now let's notice, first of all, that from verse 10 to verse 31 are 22 verses. And each verse begins with the letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It's an acrostic. And it's put together in such a way that the first verse begins with Aleph, second with Beth, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, on down the line, to everyone, to the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. It took planning to put this together. It had to be thought through. And if you knew Hebrew, the acrostic would make it easy to remember. Say, Aleph, oh yeah, this line, Beth, and you would remember the whole line. And it would be easy to put it to memory. That's what acrostics do. Now, verse 10. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. In English, this verse is presented as a question. The Sonsino commentary, which is a Jewish commentary, says that's not right. In Hebrew, they don't see it as a question. They say, the sense is, whoever has married such a woman knows from experience how priceless is her worth. It's a statement. Whoever has married such a woman knows from experience how priceless is her worth. So right from the start, the husband is involved in Proverbs 31. It's talking about the husband knows what a blessing, what a priceless blessing he's been given. And from the start, he is full of praise for his wife. He knows from experience how priceless is her worth. It says, Who can find a virtuous wife, for her worth is far above rubies? In Proverbs 3:15, the same thing is said of wisdom, that wisdom is worth more than rubies. It's more than wealth, the wealth that's around, rubies or anything else for that matter. Now, in Proverbs, wisdom is personified as a woman. And you'll find that consistently through the Proverbs. It's personified as a woman. So he's saying that her price is above rubies, and wisdom's price. They're both described the same way. Some see the closing acrostic in the Proverbs as a summation of God's instruction on wisdom, because the woman's personified through there, and then here's this virtuous woman that finishes the book of Proverbs. So people see it as a summation of God's instruction on woman. There's more in here than meets the eye, and I don't think I've got it all figured out either. But I think you'll find it interesting. It says, verse 11, the heart of her husband safely trusts in her, so he will have no lack of gain. Notice that. To trust her is safe. He safely trusts her. That's priceless. This couple enjoys mutual trust. They trust each other. And it's hard. You can't buy that. That is a wonderful blessing. And it's so important in a marriage. Proverbs 12:4 says, a wife of noble character is her husband's crown, but a disgraceful wife is like a decay in his bones. They knew about bone decay back then and how things would wear down. Proverbs 18:25, he who finds a wife finds what is good and receives favor from the Lord. If you've got a wife, a godly wife, you have been blessed by the Lord. Proverbs 19:14 says, houses and wealth are inherited from parents, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. There's no other source. You can get houses and you get wealth from parents, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. That's a great blessing. Like I presume all of you, or hopefully most of you, or Evelyn and I, trust each other. We always know that the other will be working in the best interests of the family. That's always there. And that's priceless. That is priceless. Actually, we're no longer really two, but more one. So if any of you young people are considering a mate, look for someone you respect and can trust. That's very important. Trust is right there. And the second part of the verse says, so he will have no lack of gain. That's how it's translated in the New King James, in the Hebrew, in the New Revised Standard Version. The NIV says he lacks nothing of value. There are benefits in every way when this couple is together and there's mutual trust. There are benefits beyond counting. We'll read some as we go through. You notice he's still talking about the husband and the wife, not just the wife. He's talking about the two of them. He will have no lack of gain. And he safely trusts. That's about him. And it's a wonderful, wonderful blessing. Verse 12. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She does him good. The NIV says she brings him good, not harm, all the days of her life. Now, what kind of a husband would this be? Could a lazy man have such a wife? He just lays around all day and does nothing, and she's out there working away. She's going, and she comes home and says, how's it going? I don't think so. Can he lack self-discipline and not have a certain self-discipline himself? And she's out there motivated and doing things, and he, you know, doesn't have the self-discipline. Could he be a spendthrift? Could she save and scrimp, and then he blows it? How will that work? Could he be a drunk? Could he be a wife beater? Would she still be motivated? Would she still be on fire? No. No, it has to tell you something about, it seems impossible to me. It seems that he has to be motivated and she has to be motivated. and they work together. And they're working together. As I see it, he highly respects her, and she highly respects him. And it works. Verse 13. She seeks wool and flax and works and willingly works with her hands. She's like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. Now, please notice that this woman is motivated. She's even entrepreneurial. She's willing to use her head, do things, accomplish. What motivates people? Where do motivated people come from? Do they receive a lot of criticism? Or lack of recognition, or lack of appreciation, or being constantly teased, or having faults pointed out all the time, what would that do to motivation? Well, it would drain it. Such treatment destroys motivation. You take the most virtuous woman and treat her with continual criticism, and you will discourage her quickly. Motivation will be diminished, if not killed. And it's the same for a man. You can take the best man, and with constant criticism, you suck the life out of him. This woman's motivated because she's appreciated. And she feels free to act. And she's not constantly put down. A husband and wife are getting ready for bed. The wife is standing in front of a full-length mirror, taking a hard look at herself. "You know, dear," she says, "I look in the mirror and I see an old woman. My face is all wrinkled, my hair is gray, my shoulders are hunched over, I've got fat legs and my arms are all flabby." She turns to her husband and says, "Tell me something positive to make me feel better about myself." He studies her for a moment and thinking about it, and then says in a soft, thoughtful voice, "Well, there's nothing wrong with your eyesight." The funeral service for the husband will be on Monday morning at St. Andrew's Chapel at 10:30 a.m. Motivated couples encourage each other. They share a willingness to work. They share a willingness to create, to build. They respect each other. They trust each other. Each individual using their skills to benefit the two. What a turn on. What a joy of accomplishment to be able to be in such a relationship where you're working together in total harmony and you're trying to build together in a relationship of trust and goodwill. Whether working together or separately, accomplishing worthwhile goals in harmony with your mate is a wonderful, and I'll use that word again, priceless blessing to be able to do that. The NIV says, "She selects wool and flax." It implies she looks for good quality. And understanding good quality is a big subject. But be able to, like when they go to the grocery store, we get the right tomato, we get the right grapefruit, we look it over, the pawpaw, the papaya, if you like those, we love them. Try to get them right. Understanding quality is a big subject. Notice verse 15. "She rises while it's yet night and provides food for her household." Wisdom is also said to provide food in Proverbs 9, verses 1 to 6. Wisdom does the same thing. It provides nourishment. And notice again that this lady is motivated. And she sets her alarm. He doesn't. She sets it. She's motivated. Verse 16. Well, verse 15 said she rises while it's yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her servants. She's got things organized. Verse 16. "She considers a field and buys it. From her profits, she plants a vineyard." Now, when you were growing up, What would have happened if you're home, if your mom came home and at dinner table said to your father, I bought a 10-acre vineyard today. You what? Wouldn't that be kind of a shock? I bought a 10-acre vineyard. Oh, you did, huh? How many wives feel free to do that? We just read that the husband trusted her. He sure did. He sure did. Nothing here says he even knew the transaction had taken place. If so, he wasn't present for the negotiation. You always negotiate, right? He wasn't there for the sale, and he wasn't there for the closing. I bought the field today. Now, notice he encouraged her to make important financial decisions. Now, some wives might not have the ability or the interest in doing such things. I've known people, they say, I don't want anything to do with that. Let somebody else take care of it. But some do have the ability and the interest. And that's the kind of lady that's described here. As I say, she's kind of the chief executive officer of the estate. And so we can use this field. Good. This woman is bright, capable, and financially savvy. And it says, from her profits, she plants a vineyard. She produced a profit and used it to plant a vineyard. Now, we have to understand the biblical idea of a vineyard. They symbolize prosperity. She produced a profit. And the vineyard is a sign of prosperity, as I said. In Solomon's day, it was said, things were so prosperous that every man sat under his own vine and his own fig tree. And we know that's a prophecy in Micah as well about the millennium. The prosperity will be there, that everybody will have a vine. And you know what you do with vines. Not make grape juice. I like the people talk about grape juice, you know. They say maybe it's in the Bible, it's grape juice. The first grape juice was produced at the Chicago Fair here in the 1890s. They hadn't figured out pasteurization as yet. So back there, they had to turn it into wine anyway. It was wine. Only grape juice is relatively new on the earth after Madame Curie. Figured out things along the lines of being able to store things and kill off what they didn't make it spoil. But a vineyard also demonstrates long-term thinking. A vineyard takes many years to produce quality wines. I heard that the Prohibition in the United States, where they didn't make wine, it produced a period where the American vintners were put back for 50 years. And it's only in recent decades, that they've been able to start getting American wines back up to date from the Prohibition, which kind of slowed down the whole production. And it takes a while to get going. So vineyards show long-term thinking. It's a metaphor for prosperity and long-term thinking. Verse 17, she girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. Now, we're not talking weightlifting here. that's not what we're covering. If you'll keep your finger there and look at Psalm 93, if you would, please. I think it's better for us to see it ourselves rather than me just quote it. Psalm 93. And look at verse 1. God describes himself similarly. Psalm 93, verse 1. The Lord reigns, he is clothed with majesty. The Lord is clothed, he has girded himself with strength. Surely the world is established so that it cannot be moved. God's in a position of strength. And he demonstrates his strength by his works. And so is this woman. She's in a position of strength. It says in verse 17, she girds herself with strength and strengthens her arm. It's not talking about weightlifting. It's talking about being in a strong position. And it also indicates high character and high standards and high reputation. Worthy of respect and praise. And the same thing is said of God. And he clothes himself. The more we see God's creation, we see his handiwork, we just sit in awe. And we're struck by the beauty of it. And what he does, we have a deacon who fell and hit his head up in Beloit. And in the cold, very difficult circumstances. But he had a setback. He started losing his balance because there were two spots bleeding. And inside the brain. And so his equilibrium was messed up. They wanted to drill two holes in his head. He decided to be anointed. And the bleeding stopped. And the doctors tell him, with patience, the body itself will carry off that blood. Isn't that astonishing? The blood reaches up and fixes the thing and takes it. How does it do that? The creative power of God. The mighty power of God to do that. Worthy of respect and praise. And it's the same for this woman. She's in the same thing. Same situation. Verse 18. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp does not go out by night. She perceives that her merchandise is good. She's not lacking in confidence. Today, educators try to instill self-esteem. They try to get to make them feel good, to instill self-esteem. What they're finding is they're only instilling pride and vanity, though. They took a test between Asian students and American students on math. The Asian students had high math scores and low self-esteem. The American students had terrible math scores and high self-esteem. They thought they're great. They just couldn't do math. They're finding that real, quote, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable things. And then you have a certain confidence. It's a tricky one for the world to figure out, self-esteem. For God's people, we know we don't need, want to be proud, but we can have a certain joy in accomplishment. There's a balance there. So she perceives that her merchandise is good. This lady knows that her work is high quality. And that gives a certain confidence. And her lamp does not go out by night. Now, you probably wondered about that one. The Sonsino commentary says, having a lamp on at night was an indicator of prosperity. We all usually have a little light somewhere so we can see around the place. And it mentions Jeremiah 25:10. I'll just read Jeremiah 25:10 to you. Moreover, God is saying he's going to remove blessings from Israel. He said, moreover, I will take from them the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones, that's grinding wheat, and the lamp, light of the lamp. They'll be in darkness. Job, in chapter 18, in verses 5 and 6 said, the light of the wicked indeed goes out. And the flame of his fire does not shine. The light is dark in his tent. And his lamp beside him is put out. He's not in a strong position. Then they quote a Bedouin saying, he sleeps in darkness, to indicate poverty. The guy sleeps in darkness. He didn't have any money for a light. So her light does not go out by night. She's okay. She can see. It's not that she stays awake all night, as some have suggested. Verse 19. She stretches out her hand to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. You'll notice she's not willing to break her finger to risk breaking her fingernails. Now, the distaff is the staff that holds the fiber to be woven. And the spindle is the rod that's used to twist the fiber and the thread. So she's willing to go in there and actually make the things herself. Verse 20, she extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hand to the needy. So she's generous and not stingy. In Israel, helping the poor was done by the community. You stored up things in the community. If you saw someone struggling, you helped. And as they lived in tribal groupings, remember they lived by tribes, they were assigned their inheritance by tribes, it was probably a relative anyway, or a family member somehow that wouldn't be too far away. And she had the discretion to handle this. Saw somebody in need, she had the discretion to deal with it and to help out. Notice, she's the CEO here. She made the decision. I can take it from the funds we have here, and I can put it over there and give it to this person and help them out, help them get started again. Today, we all send money to Washington. They build a huge building to house their bureaucracy. I wonder how many Social Security offices there are around and how much each one costs and how expensive is that overhead. And then they build a huge building and to house their bureaucracy, and then they send maybe 25% back to the people. I don't know what percentage. It's certainly not all of it, to help some poor. Very impersonal. And the poor don't have any thanks to the taxpayer. You ever notice that? The way our system works, they have no... Too often they thank no one. Instead, they say, tax them more and give it to me. And the politicians are happy to oblige. Back in Israel, you helped in your neighborhood. You helped with your family. You helped your people. And you helped them, and it was personal. And it was together. Satan's system tends to put people in opposition. Remember Ruth and Boaz? He was generous and kind. He was prosperous. And he was kind and he was generous. She was hardworking, respectful, and appreciative. And it built a little community spirit there together. Both management and labor could learn something from these ancestors of David, Solomon, and Jesus Christ about how to help. When it's personal, people help together. Much warmer than that. Verse 21. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestries for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. The indication there, she's prepared in advance. And notice again, quality materials, fine linen and purple. Fine linen and purple imply royalty. When Joseph was made prime minister of Egypt, when he received that promotion, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, symbolizing, "You act in my name, in my authority." And he clothed them in garments of fine linen. It's that fine linen that's the same one that's here. That she's clothed in fine linen, she's prepared. She's in good shape. And again, it implies wealth and it implies royalty. And he clothed them in fine linen and put a gold chain on his neck. Gold chain, again, even today, symbolizes public office. And it's there. You'll maybe see your mayor with a gold chain in certain ceremonial things. Maybe not. Maybe it's different here. But verse 23, her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. This kind of wife brings respect to the couple. Vice President Dick Cheney's family moved when he was a young man from to Montana. Family up went to Montana. And he once commented in a public meeting that if he hadn't moved there, his wife Lynn would have married somebody else. And then she piped up, "Then he would have been vice president." A happy and productive marriage builds many blessings. If your marriage is happy, you get many blessings. There are opportunities and advancement and recognition. If you're constantly burdened down with troubles, it tends to slow everything down. It just does. Verse 24. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies sashes to the merchants. In Isaiah 3:23, the same word is translated linen garments here, is listed in women's clothing. So she was making something for ladies. Sashes, King James says girdles, indicate sashes and belts worn around the waist. The wealthy usually had them elaborately embroidered. The word merchant there, by the way, in Hebrew is the Canaanite. It's meant a Phoenician trader. And just notice, this lady's at home in the marketplace. She can go out in the marketplace and she can trade and sell and do things. And she was capable of doing that. That wasn't a problem for her. Verse 25. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. clothed with strength and dignity, again, is a poetic application. If you look at Psalm 104, go back to the Psalms again. Psalm 104, we'll look at the first two verses. Psalm 104, verse 1, Psalm 104. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord, my God, you are very great. You were clothed with honor and majesty. You cover yourself with light as with a garment, and who stretch out the heavens like a curtain. So here, God is clothed with honor and majesty, and she is clothed with strength and honor. It means it just describes her, and it envelops her, and she just wears it as a garment. In Psalm 132, it says, let your priests be clothed with righteousness, and let your saints shout for joy. So clothed means it envelops them. Strength and honor are clothing. And it says, she shall rejoice in time to come. The NIV says, she'll laugh at the days to come. She's physically secure and prepared, and spiritually she's confident in God, as we will see a little further down in the chapter. Verse 26, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. The NIV says, she speaks with wisdom and faithful instruction. The actual word instruction there is Torah, or Torah. She speaks with faithful instruction, it's on her tongue. When she speaks, her words are worth listening to. You listen to them and you take them in because they're valuable. They're worth hearkening to. She gives sound advice. Her words reflect wisdom. The Sonsino, the Jewish commentary again, suggests that the law of kindness is actually kindly instruction. She gives instruction in a kind way. That's an important thing. Verses 28 and 29. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Arise has two possible meanings. First, it means when they arise, mom's already up and everything's in order. Second, and probably more likely, they arise as a sign of respect. They stand up to show respect. A rabbi of old was quoted as saying, when he heard his mother coming, I stand up before the Shekinah. Shekinah is a manifestation of God. And he regarded his mom as a manifestation of God. So he would stand and show respect. And call her blessed, her husband also. He praises her. Notice the husband and the children praise this lady. This is so important and is too often overlooked. It helps motivation. She is appreciated. Again, this is instruction to the husband and children. Sonsino makes an interesting point on that. They say that call her blessed is, quote, more literally, and make her happy with evidence of their appreciation and love. It's a positive thing that they verbalize their appreciation. And it makes her happy. That doesn't sound hard to understand, does it? As I say, we can look on this for instruction for both the husband and the children. Let's be sure we stand up and praise our mother and our wife. Verse 30. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is passing. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. The NIV says, charm is deceptive, and beauty is fleeting. I understand Mr. Bill Clinton is said to be charming. I've also heard that President Bush is said to be charming. So was Delilah. Everything today, Americans seem to be captured by outward appearances and celebrity. And being a celebrity is being someone who's famous for being famous. In our supermarket magazines, we see everything looks sexy, everything's on the surface. A wise potential husband or wife will look for character as the important thing. People of character understand the importance of character. And they express that, their appreciation, with praise. They express it because they appreciate it, and they give that appreciation with praise. Now it says, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. The NIV says, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. It's instruction to the husband and to the children. To that guy hiding in there. Fearing the Lord is the most beautiful characteristic of all. It's interesting, the Proverbs begin with the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And here it talks about wisdom. That a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. When somebody fears the Lord, it means that God's will is more important than their own. If God says something, well, then that's what we're going to do. Because He knows what's best for us all. And to fear the Lord means His will is more important than our own, or her own in this case. It deserves praise. And this is instruction for the guy. Every marriage partner falls short. All of us do. But those who fear the Lord remain faithful when one or the other messes up. And fearing the Lord is the big key. Because God's in the marriage then. And God's in the family. And that's absolutely vital. So it says, give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gate. Give her, in Sonsino they say, let her have full credit for all she does. Again, this is instruction. This is instruction addressed not to the wife, but to the husband and children. Guys, let's not claim for ourselves the credit and the blessings that our wives deserve. Let's pass it on. And, you know, children can tend to whine about what they don't have. It's a tendency, I'm afraid. Praising their mom, showing appreciation, I'll tell you, young people, is going to produce a far better outcome than whining about what you don't have. But praising, showing appreciation, and showing gratitude for all the work and all the love and all the concern and all the thought and all the preparation will do a lot better than whining. It says, let her own works praise her in the city gate. She may be working in the house, but she is publicly respected. My wife's mother, many of you know her, I think, Mom Thomas, Elizabeth Thomas. Several years ago, she lived in a farm in Michigan. Her car became stuck, so she started to walk. That's what farm people do. You're stuck, you start walking. And on the way there, a lady stopped to pick her up. And she said, the lady said to her, you're Mrs. Thomas, aren't you? Now, Mom didn't know the lady, but the lady knew Mrs. Thomas. She'd been on the farm for many, many years. And virtuous people are known and respected more than they know. Mom Thomas died just after Tabernacles 2004. She was 91 years old. At her funeral, I was asked to speak. As part of my comments, I felt privileged to include a number of verses from Proverbs 31. And in my view, and also in the others, the tribute fit perfectly because she just exemplified that way of life. Give her the fruit of her hands. Tell her, appreciate the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Now let's switch gears. You ready? These verses become even more enlightening when we ask, could this be a description of the bride of Christ? Talk about a virtuous woman. The bride of Christ then would be as virtuous as could be. If so, then these verses apply to all the first fruits, whether male or female, because we all participate in being part of the bride of Christ. And I think we'll all agree that Christ's bride will be motivated, will be diligent, will be kind, will be wise, will be generous, will be trustworthy, and certainly will fear God. Character, let's remember, has no gender. Character is character. Can you picture upon his return Jesus Christ saying to each member of that collective body, the bride of Christ, many daughters have